Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's a cuisine and a people few of us know, yet in a sense, we are their homeland. The Hmong people of Southeast Asia have no separate country of their own. Many brought their heritage here. Well, today I learned to cook Hmong with the authors of Cooking from the Heart, The Hmong Kitchen in America. For the Stearns, it's the fountain of youth and great pancakes at the Old Spanish Sugar Mill in De Leon, Florida. We've got your summer cook kit, the one recipe that morphs into nearly everything you're going to want to eat. Then it's the all-revealing what we eat when nobody's around. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today we're in my kitchen to learn about one of our most elusive immigrant cuisines. The Hmong people of Southeast Asia don't write down recipes and traditions. They share them face to face, family to family, until recently. The two authors of Cooking from the Heart, The Hmong Kitchen in America, give me a lesson in Hmong life. Well, our favorite analytical cook, Michael Ruhlman, the man who believes all cooking breaks down to ratios, has the one recipe that's going to make your summer. Then it's cookbook author Deborah Madison's latest research project. She and her husband, artist Patrick McFarlane, got people across the globe to talk about what they eat when they eat alone. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So Jane, Michael, latest discovery?
Lynn, in the course of our looking for the Fountain of Youth in Florida, we instead found a fountain of pancake batter at a great restaurant where you sit at a table with a griddle in the middle and pour your own for as long as you want to cook and eat pancakes.
You know, forget those Japanese places with the knives flying. This sounds far more interesting.
You know, I don't know about you, Lynn, but there are some foods that I cannot cook. I mean, I literally... like bread, for instance. I cannot make bread. Mm. And pancakes, when I make pancakes, they're these big, thick things where one side is burnt and one side is raw. And so to me, one of the great joys of going out for pancakes is that I can't screw them up. But I have to say, this was a wonderful experience.
Well, and on the other hand, to balance your problem with it is that you can pour and eat as many as you want. And plus, you're free to add bananas, blueberries, pecans, apple chunks, peanut butter, chocolate chips, whatever you want. So you can customize each individual pancake. You can make little ones. You can make big ones. You can make ones with Mickey Mouse ears if you choose. So you can do whatever you want.
And here's the best. Well, it's not the best part, but it's certainly a good part. The whole meal is $4.50 all you can eat.
Well, bacon, sausage, ham is extra, and that you don't have to cook. That they bring you from the
kitchen. But you could eat like 8,000 pancakes.
Right.
All right, but hold on a minute. We're missing an important bit of information. what is this place called?
Okay.
We're not going to tell you.
It's our little secret. No, it's actually, it's called the Old Spanish Sugar Mill, and it's inside a state park. So in order to access this place, we should say that in addition to the $4.50 tariff for the meal,
right,
you have to pay, I believe it's $3 per carload to get into the park itself.
Hey, you
not
put enough people in the car, it's nothing.
Exactly. You put people in your trunk. But
yes,
it's a beautiful, beautiful place. I mean, it's a kind of a small, manageable state park, and you know, you can go hiking. They have little boat rides you can go around. I mean, it's just beautiful.
It's the Ponce de León?
Ponce de León State Park. I mean, named for the springs that are there that are supposedly the Fountain of Youth.
You sure don't meet too many people named Ponce anymore.
No, but you know, in those days, because he was the Spanish explorer who was convinced that the Fountain of Youth existed there.
Yeah, which... That's right. And this area has been a winter resort for like about 150 or 200 years. And, you know, even after people realized they might not have the Fountain of Youth there, they went there because the water is supposedly very health-giving. Uh-huh. It's not exactly a hot springs, but supposedly swimming in this water is very salubrious for you.
Well, then you can eat all those pancakes and sink to
That's
the
right.
bottom of the
I think I would rather eat pancakes and sit in a hot spring, personally.
I'd like to do both. But, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, my dear.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Take your pills. Take your time. Take your pulse and see if you ain't dying. Hide your thoughts. You can hide your goal. You can hide your heart, but you can't hide all.
Michael Stern of the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can get the Stern's food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Last week, our neighbor, Tim Paradise, now he's one of those people with that natural Italian cooking gene. Tim made one of those dishes that was so simple, so easy. I wished it was my idea. All he did was boil up, cut broccoli, boil spaghetti, toss them together with a little bit of the pasta water, and put it on the table. Now, also on the table was olive oil, coarse salt, the pepper mill, some shaved cheese, and some hot chili. We each dressed the pasta the way we wanted. It tasted great hot, it tasted great as it cooled, and even though we had fish afterwards, we all agreed that we could have quit right after the pasta. Now, almost anything green could stand in for that broccoli and be boiled right with the pasta. If the occasional cut-up tomato or fresh herb were tossed in with the condiments, that wouldn't hurt either. I mean, let's face it, this is the kind of dish that could keep you going all summer. Guarantee of success for every cook and would-be cook is not the supreme recipe. Constant success lies in knowing what's behind that recipe. The secret of its ratios. These are the culinary codes that chefs use every day. Writer Michael Ruhlman trained with chefs at the Culinary Institute of America, and he's been translating these codes for the home cook in a series of books. His latest is Ratio, the Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking. Michael, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn. Great to be here.
So this idea of ratios, I mean, are you saying that really cooking is just as simple as if you know the ratios, you can make the dish?
Almost, but not quite. You need a little bit of technique, but with, you know, when you have the ratios at your fingertips, then all of the rest of cooking is just like, you know, just going downhill. It makes it so much easier.
You divide the book up into sections, and mm-hmm. one of the sections is, for me,
the sexiest sauces you will ever have, and they have what I think is the worst sounding official title, fat-based sauces. I mean, that is such a hard sell, for goodness sakes.
I'm glad you called them sexy. They truly are. You're absolutely right.
Oh, these are fabulous. But can you step us through how they work, the ratios on these?
Sure. The fat-based sauces are the mayonnaise, vinaigrette, and the emulsified butter sauces, the hollandaise and béarnaise sauces, are all a ratio of fat and all have some liquid in them, and some of them are emulsified with using the help of an egg yolk.
Mm-hmm.
But to stick with the simplest one, the vinaigrette, which is, you know, something that everybody uses in some form or another, is one of the most versatile sauces ever created. It's simply three parts fat and one part acid or something, you know, something sour, whether it's lemon juice or sherry vinegar. And if you know that, then you have 1,000 vinaigrettes at your disposal, 3-to-1. And you can go by volume here, 3 ounces of oil and 1 ounce of sherry vinegar. That's your basic vinaigrette. You mix that together and it's going to be fine. But mm-hmm. if you add a little chopped shallot to that and some salt and pepper, you've got a nice sherry shallot vinaigrette. You add a little Dijon mustard to that. You've got a Dijon mustard vinaigrette. Add some fresh herbs to that. Add some spices to that. But if you stick to the 3-1 ratio, you can't go wrong. It all depends on what you are after, what kind of effect. Maybe you're using the vinaigrette on a piece of white fish that you've sautéed. We don't always think about vinaigrettes on salads. Think about them on grilled meats, for instance, or fish.
Yeah, and also grilled vegetables.
Grilled vegetables, it's great. It's a really fabulous sauce, an idea, 3 parts oil, 1 part vinegar, that can be infinitely varied as you need it.
Now, I always heard that a salad dressing is a marinade waiting to be appreciated. So I could take my basic vinaigrette, add things to it, and then I could use them to marinate almost anything I'm going to grill, right?
Absolutely.
Michael, can you do vinaigrettes ahead? I mean, can you keep them for a couple of days?
Sure you can. You can make a vinaigrette base and just have the acid and fat mixed together in the right proportion, and then add shallot, add herb, add whatever you want. You can make it up to a week in advance. You can even emulsify it if you want. You can add mustard and other condiments like that for flavor. The thing you can't do is add fresh herbs or shallot ahead of time. Those mm-hmm. will give you an off flavor if they're kept. But you can definitely have a vinaigrette base at the ready all the time just to essentially add garnish to when you needed it.
And should you keep it in the fridge or can you keep it on the counter?
I would keep it in the fridge.
Uh-huh, yeah. This is great. This frees us for the summer. And when I think of what we pay for a jar of, you know, made-up dressings.
Oh, it's a ripoff. It's a heist. And they're not as good as what you can make fresh at home. And it's no more faster. In fact, it costs you money and time to buy those bottled dressings.
This is great. Hey, Michael, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Lynn.
Michael Ruhlman is author of Ratio, The Simple Codes Behind the Craft of Everyday Cooking. Now, find his recipes for warm tomato vinaigrette and its variation, chimichurri sauce, on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to also check out all of our other opportunities. Weeknight Kitchen, our attempt to make your worknight cooking easier. You get a new recipe each week along with tips and assorted discoveries. Our podcast so that you can take us along wherever you may wander. And information in our book, How to Eat Supper, inspired by this very show. Well, it's all there, you know, splendidtable.org. Coming up, an elusive immigrant cuisine, what we eat when nobody's around, and messages on your plate. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Just Bear Chicken, all natural, with a simple commitment to natural food and respect for both animals and planet. Just Bear Chicken. Go minimal. You can learn more at justbearchicken.com. With all the Asian food we eat in America, would you believe that there's an Asian cuisine we are clueless about? We know next to nothing about the Hmong people and their food. Now, part of this is because the Hmong have not had a written language until very recently, the 1950s, and that food has just not been documented.
until now. Sammy Scripter and Shane Yang have pulled together a collection from all 18 of the Hmong clans called Cooking from the Heart. They arrived in my kitchen complete with Hmong mortar and pestle, the cone-shaped basket for steaming sticky rice, the vase-shaped rice pot, bags and bags of chilies and fresh herbs, and a handmade Hmong knife that's more machete than slicer. We set out to make the national dish. It's called larb.
Okay, so what can I do to help?
Everything's clean, so we can chop the onion.
Shane, we don't need all of this mint. We want to save some sort of for a garnish.
All right.
Does that look great?
To make larb, you always have to use mint, cilantro, and green onions.
Yeah.
And it is the national dish of Laos. It's a meat salad that is can be made with any kind of meat. We're going to make it with chicken today. And then all of these marvelous fresh herbs, always hot chilies, always toasted sticky rice, powder. We're going to grind that in the coffee grinder that I brought. But always, always the mint.
Mm-hmm.
Writing a book with people that don't have a history of a written language was absolutely fascinating. So for instance, if, you know, there's clans, Hmong or clans, and if you want to know if you are related to another person, you have to find someone that has the oral tradition for that particular clan, and they can recite back for, you know, ancestors and ancestors who the what the lineage is. Only oral, and they still don't write it down. It's still not in books. And I'm, you know, I was the outsider, so I did all the interview. I was always interviewing people, and I would ask the old people what, you know, what was important. What was important for our cookbook? And I had more than one grandmother tell me, you know, we don't need to write it down. We know how to do our cooking, and if we choose to cook another way, well then, that's what we'll be doing then. We don't need to have it written down. This particular dish is almost always made when you have a lot of company.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would have 20 women in the kitchen chopping and
chopping using together.
And then the men would be out on the back porch with the big knives chopping the meat.
When you're eating this, would this be served as one of many, many dishes? Or could I make larb for supper?
And
I
mean,
and with sticky rice.
Yes.
And that's dinner. With some broth, perhaps?
Yeah, you have to have some broth. So my family, we eat about between 3 to 5 dish every night. And larb probably won't be one of our entree. We can have fish, pork, or beef, or chicken. Then I will do at least 2 veggie dish, one without meat and the other one with meat. And I also will have a soup along with it. And the chili condiment and the rice.
The thing that I was so surprised at in the book was that often the broth you talk about is as simple as just putting lemongrass in water and then cooking vegetable or meat in that water, and that's the broth.
Oh, yeah.
That's so much easier.
Yes,
than
a lot of easy. Just put lemongrass
so,
in there.
So simple.
And that's
simple.
It. Very simple.
We chopped and chopped and chopped some more. The room was fragrant with lime leaf and mint. And while we were working, I dug into some controversial recent history. I asked them to tell me the story about Hmong involvement during the Vietnam War.
They were recruited by the CIA, and they formed the CIA's secret army in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And it really changed the structure of Hmong living because the families moved to be close to the air bases in Laos so that they could feed their men who were fighting. And the purpose of the Hmong, the jobs the Hmong men got were to harass the Chinese as they brought supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos.
Right.
And it was a secret. We were not supposed to be doing, you know, these operations in Laos. And so they were our allies. They believed in what we believed in. And they also served as pilots and airmen. And they were the people that rescued downed pilots, American pilots that were shot down over Laos, because they were terrific. They really knew the jungle. They really knew the mountains. And they could
rescue a downed pilot and bring them to safety. And then after we pulled out, of course, they were left in a country that was then entirely controlled by the communist forces that they had been fighting, which put them in terrible peril in enemy territory. Mm-hmm. And many of the families did find their way out. They had to go however they could, on foot, a lot of them, crossing the Mekong River, ending up in camps in Thailand. And then over the years, they were relocated by helping agencies, many of them to the United States and many of them to France. So there are people without a country, but that means they've always adapted to being a minority within a majority population, and they've always made the best of whatever situation they land in.
At this point, everything was done except the chicken. Tiny Shane, wielding an honest-to-God Hmong machete, began to furiously chop the chicken on a big wooden board. She was like a machine, chopping and re-chopping until the chicken was in more of a paste than in bits. It was dropped into an unoiled, flaming hot wok, and minutes later, we were seated at my kitchen table. The lard was arranged on a big white platter with leaves of lettuce, bundles of fresh herbs, mint, coriander, slices of cucumber and lime, and a heaping pile of the chicken, which was mixed with more chopped herbs and the ground toasted rice. The fragrance and the colors were stunning.
I'd like to go as fast as I can go.
Oh, that is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Crunchy and delicious. And it tastes like nothing that you could imagine. It's wonderful. Thank you both.
Well, we really appreciated you having us here. Thank you. It's been a wonderful morning.
You guys can come to my kitchen any time you want.
You sure you mean that?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, at my house, when I serve this, I do serve this as the main, like a hot summer day.
Yeah.
Out on the porch.
Sammy Scripter and Shane Yang are authors of Cooking from the Heart, The Hmong Kitchen in America. Now, you can find the recipe for the chicken larb, Laotian chicken and herb salad that we made, right on the website, splendidtable.org. By yourself, what do you eat for supper? All the tater tots you want? A bowl of cereal? Or a choice little morsel of something precious that you coddle into a matchless culinary moment? Well, maybe the answer doesn't reveal some deep, dark secret of your soul, but it's sure fun to find out. Which is what brought cookbook author Deborah Madison and her husband, artist Patrick McFarlane, to write and illustrate their new book, What We Eat When We Eat Alone. Deborah, Patrick, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, Patrick, what is it like to eat and live with Deborah Madison?
Oh, it's a lot of fun, I tell you that. You know, it's a laugh a minute.
Do you ever get cross-eyed with all the food talk?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because that's where this whole book started. Over a period of years, Deborah and I traveled to Europe with a think tank called Old Ways Preservation and Trust. And this was a large group of chefs and food writers, and they talked about food continually. So I had to kind of, you know, get something going. During these travels, I began asking people the question, what do you eat when you eat alone? It was a kind of icebreaker to break through all that food talk.
With more food talk.
With more food talk. Yes.
Technical food talk. This was more down to earth. And so I took notes. And
one day I found them, and I thought, this is so amazing. It's hilarious. We should do something with these notes. It's very compelling. It's interesting. It's funny.
What do you two eat when you eat alone?
Oh, my gosh. I'm kind of a vegetables on toast person. I love to make a little vegetable stew or a sauté of vegetables, toast, and rub it with garlic and olive oil and slices of good cheese and put that all together and sit down and have a glass of wine.
Deborah, you are so civilized.
Well, that's only when I'm civilized. A lot of times, I have to say, I'm not very civilized.
Oh, we can be barbarians, for sure.
Actually, one of my favorite eat-alone dishes was from Aglaya Kremezi, who was a chef on those trips, but she's also a friend independently of that. She lives in Greece, mm-hmm. and she liked fried potatoes cut kind of thick and just basically simmered in olive oil, and then she served them with a yogurt sauce. And you add enough mustard to the yogurt to make it kind of dirty and unattractive. And that was the key to get it right. And then she said, and of course I have that with a glass of wine. It's very good.
I guess, you know, I'm looking for the thrill and chills here.
Oh.
Because I think people do things when we're alone that we would never do when anybody's watching.
Yes, the unshareable foods, there's definitely a category for those. And we didn't make recipes out of them, I have to tell you, because they were just that bizarre. For example, one person liked margarita mix poured over potato sesame bread. Don't ask. Or a mustard sandwich with reworked coffee, meaning he poured water through the grounds he had had earlier in the day. Or a leftover spaghetti sandwich where a person made a sandwich with last night's spaghetti and the leftover salad as well thrown in. I mean, these are just not foods that you can share with other people. And sometimes they're so terrible, you say, who might do these things? Well, it turns out your friends do.
I have to say, though, I remember something about the juice of the canned sardine. Was it over stale bread?
Oh,
Cottage cheese. Yeah,
that was a bad one. But then there was sort of a good variation of that where somebody took the oil from canned smoked oysters and poured that over their pasta.
Well, that sounds pretty swell.
Yeah,
that sounds
swell. It's not bad at all, actually.
But it is a realm for confession, the whole thing, that question.
Well, any difference between the way men and women, for instance, I mean, did women do more of that kind of civilized thing than men?
Well, we have a chapter of this called The Gestalt of Eating and the difference between the way men and women eat. And definitely there is a difference. You know, a woman will have a chili cheese dog, something like that, once a month. Mm-hmm. But a man might have it 3-4 times.
And also men tend to swig, women tend to sip. The verbs we found that men use in describing how they cooked were a little more aggressive. They slap, they stick, they throw, they
slam
things, whereas women tend to, you know, cut, dice, peel, and actually cook something together.
Yeah, and the thinking about all the reasons why we eat alone, too. I mean, sometimes it's out of actual loneliness. Sometimes it's mm-hmm. out of, thank God I'm finally have some time to myself kind of thing. And that's got to motivate a lot, too.
Oh, yeah. Especially women, but not always women alone. But those who've suddenly found themselves liberated from their husbands and children and had no responsibilities to cook for others and clean up, they were so happy. You can just feel and taste their freedom. And one of the women said, basically, it's about carbs and salt. You know, I just might want to have a bowl of oatmeal and with coarse sea salt on it, and I might eat it in the bathtub or on the couch or in the bed or 11 o'clock at night or 2 in the afternoon. You know, it just gets reduced very quickly to the minimal things that satisfy, which is very different than someone who's living alone all the time and really is more obligated to and inspired to make a real meal for themselves.
Yeah, yeah. You too. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Deborah Madison and Patrick McFarlane are authors of What We Eat When We Eat Alone. Now, you can find Deborah's take on Patrick's pimento cheese recipe on the website, splendidtable.org.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
The lines are open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Let's see, who is calling? We have Nevin calling from Chestertown, Maryland. Did I pronounce that correctly, Nevin?
That's correct.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, my girlfriend Morgan's birthday is coming up pretty soon, and as I like to say, she was born without a sweet tooth.
How lucky!
Well, it depends how you look at it, I guess. But, of course, most things you'd serve for a birthday are sweet.
Right.
And I decided to, last year, make something that looked sweet but wasn't. So I made a cornbread cake with a tomato filling and just a plain whipped cream topping.
That sounds great.
Well, it was okay. So I'm looking for something this year that I can make for her that'll be special, that will taste great. You know, that'll look like something sweet, but in fact is actually something really savory.
Does she like little shots of sweet? You know, like for instance, a grilled pork chop with a little honey on it. You know what I'm saying? That kind.
Yeah, that might be all right.
Yeah. Does she like blue cheese by any chance?
She does. Yeah.
She does. There's a dessert that a chef here in Minneapolis did a long time ago. His name is Tim McKee. And he took thin, thin butter pastry, like a really flaky pie crust.
Okay.
But you could do this even with really thin slices of dense, good artisan bread that you lightly butter and toast, okay? He took blue cheese. And he spread that on the pastry, and he'd put salted pistachio nuts, if I remember correctly, and he'll forgive me, hopefully, if I'm getting this wrong. You do like a little stack. You'd cut the bread into small squares, and you make it like a little Napoleon. You know what I mean? Like a little layer cake, except you instead of cake, you've got this thin toast. And the idea is that you do the cheese on this lightly buttered bread. You put the shelled salted pistachio nuts on that, and you do a little drizzle of honey. Then you put another butter, crisp, thin slice of the bread, of the toast, and so on, and you build it up. And then at the top, you could end up by swirling in some fresh cheese, some cream cheese that you've whipped with sour cream, or you could do a dab of mascarpone.
Right.
So that's one way to go. You know, you can make a bread pudding that's savory with a really nice bread that is maybe a bread with some nuts in it. I'm thinking of things like, you know, the flaxseed, whole wheat, pumpkin seed, artisan bread, you know, that's as dense as can be. And you can make a custard that just like you would be making a quiche with cheeses and half and half or milk or heavy cream, whatever you want, and milk. But then what you might do is put in there fresh basil, crisped pieces of bacon, not a lot of bacon fat, but you've cooked the bacon and crumbled it up.
Right. Okay.
And you could do cheddar cheese and Gruyere cheese, and you slow bake that. Okay. And then what you do is just cut a very small square. Just serve it in small, small pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be almost dainty, but it could be really, really fabulous.
Right.
So that's another way to go.
Yeah.
And the other thing you could do with that, by the way, is the idea of your tomatoes in the middle of the cornbread.
Uh-huh.
You could cook an intense tomato sauce with fresh tomatoes and garlic and basil and just stir that, like marbleize that bread pudding. After you get the milk and the custard in, and after you get the cheese in, you just stir this in so you have streaks, generous streaks or tunnels of the tomato.
Yeah.
So that might work. Does any of this sound like something she'd enjoy?
I think so. I might have to try them all.
There's a sweet sour eggplant dish that is done in Sicily. It's called Camponata. And the Progresso people make a canned version of it that, believe it or not, it's been around for so many years, and it's really good. And it's done with eggplant, and it has olives in it, and it has capers, and it has a little sugar and vinegar and garlic and onion, and it's like a relish. Oh. And if you were to take a piece of, like, fresh goat cheese or a cheese she might really like and pile that campanada on top of it and stick a candle in it, it could really be pretty. I mean, it could really be very, very, very nice.
All right.
I hope you folks have a great birthday celebration.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll love it.
Hey, thanks for calling, Devin.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
Bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the latest way to hydrate on the International Space Station? Now, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the latest way to hydrate on the International Space Station? On May 21st, 2009, the astronauts on the space station were joined by the NASA control room in a toast. They raised their plastic bags of the most personal water they'll ever sip. It was recycled from their very own urine. And wait, it gets better. Also their sweat and the water condensed from their exhaled air. Their plastic bags read, "Drink this when real water is over 200 miles away." Everyone was cheering this brilliant new technology, 20 years in the making. But I've got one question. How far will they go? Will this recycled potable be recycled again and again and again? I mean, green is one thing, but yellow is another. Okay, enough already. Let's get back to your calls. The number's 800-537-5252. We have got Rob on the line calling from Astoria, New York. Hey, Rob, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Some friends of mine run a supper club out here in New York where we go around to different, you know, lofts and apartments and whatnot and host a big dinner party for people.
Right.
And they're having one in my backyard in Queens. So we were discussing the menu, and the theme was rustic Italian barbecue.
Right.
And I have this great smoker, so I said, why don't we try to smoke some boar, some cingale?
Oh, that'd be fabulous.
That's what I had hoped.
My Tuscan soul is just yearning right now.
So I, you know, knowing I was cooking for a lot of people, I wanted to do a couple of test runs before we, you know, the main event. So I found a ranch in Texas that I ordered a boar leg from. And I brined it, and I smoked it, and it was, I like to call it my dry run, because it was extremely dry.
So we
decided to move on and try a shoulder, and my butcher in Queens, who's fantastic, said he could get me fresh boar shoulder. So he got me a boar shoulder, and I brined it, and the research I had done online indicated that you had to get it to like 180 degrees for a certain amount of time to break down the collagen.
Right.
Science stuff I don't really understand, but...
Yeah, but it's more like 160, 165.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
That's going to give you a very different result.
Interesting. So I got it to 180 in my smoker, and this was much better as a shoulder, but it was still much drier than I would have liked.
Well, first of all, this has got to be a very expensive venture that you're going into.
It's been an expensive couple of tests so far, so that's why I don't want to do any more tests before before we get going on this.
Yeah. All right. Two things. First of all, the leg is going to be really lean, especially on a wild animal.
Yeah.
But the shoulder always has more marbling, even on game. And game is always generally leaner than the domesticated version of the animal. Two things. First of all, you want to cook it really, really, really slow. Okay. Secondly, 160, 165 is a very good thing to aim at the center of this baby, though. You know, you don't want to have this be under that temperature. And if it's a little safer to take it a little further, you know, if you want to be sure that it's that temperature right down to the center of the meat, because this is a blocky, thick piece of meat.
I see.
But the other thing is, how have you been brining it? How long have you been brining it?
I've been brining it for, you know, it's pretty much maybe 14 hours on the first two with, you know.
How much does the shoulder weigh?
About 8 pounds.
And how thick is it?
I'd say at least 8 inches, you know, in...
In thickness.
Yeah.
All right. Generally speaking, I mean, there's a lot of variations on this. I'd cut down your brining time.
Really?
What kind of? Tell me about your brine. What's your brine?
I was doing, I think it worked out to, I had read that a cup of salt per gallon of brine was the way to go, but if you're using kosher salt, that you needed actually more because it's fluffier. So I would say probably 2 cups to each gallon of water.
You overdid the salt. That's one thing.
I did. Interesting.
Yeah, because believe it or not, that actually – was it very salty when you tasted it?
No, it didn't taste that salty, and the flavor was great even on the leg. It just was – the moisture was gone.
Right. I think here's the deal. If you over-brine too long or you have too much salt in the brine, it's actually drawing moisture from – the leg. And if you go too far, you can end up having it dry out. This is what I would try. I would try to stick with, let's say, 1 1/4 cup of kosher salt to the gallon of water. And I would suggest that you brine 1 hour per pound of meat.
1 hour per pound. Okay.
Yeah. I usually do 1 hour per thickness, per inch.
Per inch.
Only because, in a funny way, it can be better to underbrine than overbrine.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it may end up being juicier and tender. But the other thing is, you smoke it slowly.
Okay.
But don't take it beyond about 165.
Okay.
If you can do that. And hold it at that temperature until it's 165 all the way through.
Okay.
And I think you'll get a better result. You're still dealing with extremely lean meat.
Right.
But I think this should work. And the other thing is you slice it really thin.
Really thin. Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's going to work.
And we're going to sauce it as well, which will help add some, you know,
that's
moisture
always,
back in.
Saucing is a good thing.
Yeah.
Hey, it sounds like a great feast, Rob. Have a ball.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome.
Take care.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252. We have Nina on the line from Burke, Virginia. Nina, what do you want to talk about?
Well, speaking of salt, as you were just talking about.
Yes.
I have some salt questions.
Okay.
I was recently seduced by a bag of salt.
I beg your pardon.
I was in a specialty store. I love to experiment with ingredients.
Right.
I was in this little Italian specialty store, and I saw this Trapani sale Di Guicciardo Vincenzo, from Sicily.
Oh, golly. Oh, yeah.
I just had to buy it, and then I got it home and thought, I've never played with exotic salt before. And I just, this is part of the seduction. This is on their bag. Is during the summer, it is possible to feel with us, in the shining whiteness, the emotion of the salt harvesting that takes place with traditional systems.
Only Italians can
exactly
write that way.
Appunto.
Yes. Yeah.
And so my question is, I've never really played with anything other than kosher salt.
Right.
Is there something that I would do with this, like, any exotic salt to do justice to it?
Well, what you've got there is from the west coast of Sicily, from Trapani. And it is salt that is made in the old way. There are pans, in so many words, hollowed out areas right near the sea where the water washes in. And then as the tide goes out, it leaves the seawater behind.
Mm-hmm.
And the sun evaporates the water, and what's left is salt. And you can visit these. Now, I have heard, I am not sure if this is true, that they have been there since 3,000 years ago when the Greeks.
On the bag it says built in 1540.
Oh, well, that's a new business. These are the Johnny Come Latelys of the salt world in Trapani. Yes. Yeah. But you get the point. You know, it's been going on a long time. Now, this salt, a lot of people, everybody. All right. Back up. Okay, Lynn, now get to the beginning. The beginning is that sea salt will taste different from one sea or one area to another,
mm-hmm,
because of micro elements in it. I mean, salt is sodium chloride,
mm-hmm,
but there are all these other little things that get into the salt that taste a little bit different. Every area will tell you that their sea salt is the paragon of sea salts,
mm-hmm,
and that why would you want to waste your time on anybody else's? Now, for Sicilians, this is one of the sea salts that everybody goes nuts over.
Yeah.
With a sea salt like this, if you want to taste the salt, I mean, it's delicious in anything you put it in, but you want to go for really, really simple, like poached fish. you know, barely simmered. You take it out. You put it on a plate. You have a bottle of olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
You have a wedge of lemon, and you sprinkle that Trapani sea salt on it.
Ah.
You will taste the salt. You will taste the fish in all its purity, and it will be just fabulous. You could, for instance, I like to toss that kind of sea salt with almonds, a little bit of olive oil, tiny bit just so it holds on, and then you toss that salt with the almonds. So the idea here is that you use it in very, very simple dishes where you're going to taste it. So it means on meats, on vegetables, green beans with a good sea salt.
So you're not going to use this to season your pasta water?
No, because that gets very expensive.
It would, wouldn't it?
But when the pasta comes out, and if you do it with a little oil and garlic and you do a really simple sauce, this is the salt you want to use. Now, is yours in coarse granules?
It is coarse.
That's great, because you're going to get crunch out of that,
which
gives you more of the character and the flavor. Now, this is not going to taste dramatically different from your kosher salt, but you'll detect slight differences. Now, one other, I mean, obviously, meats, most vegetables, potatoes are a great neutral for salt.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and a good baked potato, I don't know. I mean, for me, a good baked potato that's really simple with a little bit of salt on it is just fabulous. The simpler, the more naked, if you want to taste that salt, because one of the fun things to do is to take something like a potato and use different sea salts on it and see if you can tell the difference. That's not a test. No, that's just the idea of, really, is there a difference here? Or are we all crazy? You're talking to a woman who right now probably has six different sea salts.
Well, that was another one of my questions. Am I just seduced by the bag, or is there really...
Oh, of course you're seduced by the bag. We all are. And who wouldn't be?
But that, you know, it's possible in the shining whiteness.
To maybe have a moment of reality. There's sea salt from the Mediterranean at the Camargue, which is the southern part of Provence, right on the water.
Mm-hmm.
It can be really distinctive. Some of the most famous salt is Maldon salt from England. People claim they can taste the difference there. There's a pink salt that comes out of Hawaii. It's baked with clay. Well, really what it is, the real stuff is, and that's almost impossible to get, is those salt pans are in earth that's very, very, has a lot of iron in it. So they're actually, the earth is red. But you can buy pink salt from Hawaii, which, by the way, sells for $3 a pound in Hawaii. Here, you will be charged a fortune.
Yeah.
But that salt has a earthy quality because they bake it with some of the soil that has a lot of iron in it.
Ooh.
And they use it a lot on seafood. So you see, you can fool around with this. But I would say just with the Trapani salt, try it on really, really simple things.
Yeah.
And now you will revel in salt. Thank you, Nina.
Thank you.
You take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Call us 800-537-5252. Now, I have a thought for you. Bite into an apple and the cosmos shifts. Well, that's kind of the theory behind the work of Dr. Dean Radin. He is senior scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Now, the concept is everything is interconnected. So some food producers have taken that idea and they're beginning to imbue their edibles with good vibes. A chocolatier's candies get 5 days of Tibetan monk's brainwaves, and a protein powder is being chanted over by workers. Well, we have Dr. Dean Radin with us. Dr. Radin, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
So do you sometimes feel like you've sort of supplied the current to make an edible Frankenstein?
I'm not sure I would put it that way. I was just off in the lab doing my own work, and the food manufacturer showed up one day and said, why is mom's chicken soup taste better than the same ingredients out of a can? And we started talking about that issue, which seems to devolve back into the intention of the cook. And most of my research has involved the role of intention in the physical world. And so we decided, and this is specifically referring to Jim Walsh, who owns a chocolate plantation, we decided to see whether intention, when applied to chocolate, off-the-shelf chocolate, whether the mood elevation that you would normally expect with chocolate because of the caffeine and the theobromine, whether that mood elevation could be increased if it was simply applied with intention, good intentions. So So he knew some Tibetan Buddhist monks outside of Madison, Wisconsin, where he lives, and they agreed to meditate over it. It wasn't their brainwaves per se. It was simply the act of their meditation applied to the chocolate with good intentions, such that anybody who ate the chocolate would feel better. Their mood would improve.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought a while and figured, well, that actually could be made into the same kind of experiment that you would do if you were testing a new drug, a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. And what that means is that you have some samples of chocolate that have been meditated over, and you have identical forms of chocolate that have not, and now you recruit a bunch of people to participate in an experiment, and you randomly assign the treated and the untreated chocolate to them, and they don't know which one they get. And us as experimenters, we don't know either. We're kept blind to it. And then over the course of a week, at the end of each day, each person fills out a standardized mood questionnaire.
Right.
And so we did the experiment, and to my shock, really, we found exactly what we were hypothesizing might occur, that the people who ate the intentional chocolate, as we called it, they had ended up with a 67% improvement in mood as a group, which was statistically significant, as compared to the control group. So somehow people perceive that there's something different about the food. And so we might be talking about something as simple or as almost simple as an informational change, that the act of intention as applied to food or actually any object can be perceived by people in ways that we don't quite understand yet.
Fascinating. Thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Dr. Dean Radin is senior scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Virginia Woolf. She said, "One cannot think well, love well, sleep well, if one has not dined well." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.